This is the Microsoft Cloud Show, episode 145, where today CJ and I are going to catch up on some news around Office, SharePoint, Azure, Google Cloud, Docker, some listener questions. We're going to do it all. Recorded live August 23rd, 2016. Welcome to the Microsoft Cloud Show, the only place to stay up to date on everything going on in the Microsoft Cloud world, including Microsoft Azure, Office 365, SharePoint, and the competitive landscape and related technologies. Just the information, no marketing, no BS. I'm Andrew Connell.
And I'm Chris Johnson.
Send us a tweet either to the show at MS Cloud Show or to Andrew at Andrew Connell.
Or Chris at LoungeFlyZ.
As we'd love to connect with you. We're just two dudes telling you how we see it. The Microsoft Cloud Show is sponsored by Valid NL. Valid is a Microsoft Gold partner whose mission is to enable its customers to excel in their business through the innovative use of technology. Valid is always on the lookout for consultants, architects, and engineers. Do you know Azure, Business Intelligence and Analytics, .NET, Office 365, or SharePoint? Look them up on valid.nl. We're recording live August the 23rd, but people aren't going to hear this till September the 6th. We're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. But hey, man, how's it going, CJ?
Very well, my friend. How are you?
Doing good. Yeah, we had a couple interviews that we were able to record back-to-back. And publish those pretty quick. So I know we've gotten a little bit ahead of ourselves. And so people are going to hear some of this stuff maybe about 2 weeks old once they, some of the news we're talking about maybe somewhat old news, but it'll be new news to some people who hadn't heard it.
Yeah, exactly. It's always nice to be ahead a little bit so we don't feel as rushed. But we've had some really good shows recently. And
if you don't say so yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, well, you know, I haven't been involved, so they must have been awesome. Yeah, one with Alex Pierce, obviously, that came out this week that we're recording. Kathy Dew as well, about women in technology. That was pretty awesome as well. I haven't listened to the Alex Pierce one yet. That's a job for today, though.
What do you think about the Kathy Dew show? We got a lot of really good feedback about that one.
I really liked it. As a father of a daughter, it was fascinating to me. Really interesting. And made me think a lot. I listened to it in the car and I was pondering life on the way into work.
Yeah, the diversity in the workforce, not only just with gender diversity, but also with like race. And it's been something that's always kind of been on my mind or bothered me. And I hate the fact that it seems like so many, like you and me seem like a very strong stereotype in this business, like, you know, white guys that are developers.
Yep.
And it's irritated me or it's bothered me. And so it's nice to see that these things are these issues are being more talked about a lot more these days. And I was really happy to get Kathy on the show. I was really happy to see some of the feedback and the reaction we got. And then the thing with Alex's episode too, it was funny. I'm curious to see what people's interest is on that one, because as we were recording it, my wife was in the room when I was recording it. She didn't get to hear what Alex was saying. She could hear what I was saying as I had my headphones on. And she was like, we had just, you know, the kids had just started school that week at elementary school. And she wants to take the episode and hand it off to a lot of the teachers and stuff because they're using technology in a bunch of different ways. And so she found a lot of the stuff we were talking about pretty interesting, only hearing one side of the conversation. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
So
that's really cool.
Yeah. So what you been up to, man?
We are cramming towards Ignite. We got our beta Hyperfish directory analyzer out. I mentioned it on the show a few weeks back, and actually we've had a couple of people who'd listened to the show that have ended up trying it and getting in touch with us, dropped me an email and things like that. So that was pretty awesome.
Oh, cool.
Thanks for all of you who have helping us out with our beta and trying out our preview. So we're busily incorporating feedback from that and trying to lock things down on the march towards Ignite, where we're going to launch our full product. So that's keeping me pretty busy. Last week, I went to SharePoint Fest in Seattle, conference that was up here in the Seattle area, which was really cool. There were a lot of familiar faces in town, speakers and so forth. We hosted a little sort of social event at Hyperfish HQ and took everybody out for a little cruise around Lake Washington, which was really fun. We had Jason Himmelstein and Mark Rackley here and a bunch of Ben Nyland from ShareGate and John Patrick White.
Matthias, I think.
Yeah. Matthias was there, yeah. We had a bunch of people actually over. It was really cool. We showed them through what we're building for Ignite, gave them a sort of a private sort of sneak peek of our full product. And then we went for a cruise on the lake and went and stalked Bill Gates' house and took a cruise around the waterfront and took a look at some of the nice houses. I think that the star of the show was a house in a little bay called Maidenbower Bay, which is kind of very luxurious bay. Let's just say that. There's a lot of big houses there.
Yeah.
But the house that really stole the show was one individual's house who has a full-size actual T-Rex skeleton in his lounge.
Really?
Yep.
Sometimes people have just too much money.
Yeah. So this is obviously an early Microsoft exec who's no longer with the company, but who funds archaeological digs and so forth and goes hunting for bones. And he's dug up quite a few T-Rex skeletons, as I understand it now. But yeah, he has a full-size T-Rex skeleton erected in his lounge. And you can see it. So when you're on the water, it's got big windows up the front of his house, and you can go past, you see this T-Rex skeleton. It's pretty badass. It's like, what are you going to do? Oh, I've got T-Rex in my lounge.
That's kind of but amazing, funny little cocktail conversation at the house and everything. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's nothing like, you know, hunting for bones.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding.
So yeah. We had a blast, actually. It was really fun having everybody over and showing them through what we've been up to. The show was really fun. It was good to see a bunch of exhibitors in the exhibit hall and sessions that were going on. So great couple of weeks.
Awesome. That's really cool.
How about you?
Just same old, same old. Just kind of plugging away, working on a project right now and eyes deep in Docker and working with Azure APIs. And it's fun. It's a lot of fun. It's playing with a whole bunch of different stuff here. But yeah, so we've got... You know, it's funny because you were talking a little bit about Ignite. Hey, we got some cool little things to share with everyone on the podcast, listeners of the podcast, about what our plans are at Ignite. So in the last week or so, I was on the fence about going to Ignite. I had booked, I think I had mentioned a previous show where I had booked, I think, 1 or 2 days at the expo hall. And then someone made a comment to me and I decided, you know, what the heck, let me give it a shot. And I reached out to Ignite and tried to not being disingenuous, I'm actually being honest about it, is that the main reason I wanted to go is for this podcast and see what we can do to help out with help push news out there and get interviews and all that kind of stuff. So what I'm doing is I reached out and I actually flagged as press now or media with the conference. So it's interesting to see the behind the scenes for like what the media guys and the press guys are going to do. So now I'm going to be there for the whole week covering things like the keynote, covering things like little meetings that you can do with execs and stuff and some other stuff. So it'll be interesting. Now I get to be there the entire week of Ignite covering it for the podcast. And with that, we've actually got a few things that we get to share with people. So that week, if you guys subscribe to our mailing list or watch us on Twitter and listen to this show, the shows we'll have leading up to it, we'll share any additional plans that we have coming up. But we do have a few things that we can share today. One thing that we are doing is that we're going to be broadcasting a live show on Wednesday of the conference. So I believe it's going to be Wednesday morning. Things kind of have been moving around on us a little bit. But Microsoft has offered to host our podcast and CJ and I will be doing a live show. Now, I don't know if that's live with video. I know it's definitely going to be live with audio and we're still going to record it. It'll still be a show that we push out to all of our listeners. So you will get to listen to it or maybe even see it if it's a video show. But we're working on the format of that. CJ and I are trying to figure some stuff out. Maybe have some live questions, maybe have some live guests, maybe slip into the show. We'll see. But definitely keep in touch with us. We'll definitely let you know on Twitter and in our mailing list what we do with that.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll probably be, I suspect, the studio where they do the recording, kind of be like the Channel 9 stuff that they have at various shows. And so we may be able to have Cloud Show listeners come up and participate in the recording somehow, and or at least show up and take a gander at it being put together. So we'll keep you posted on that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Let us know now. Start reaching out now. Send us a message through like our questions form on our website. Let us know if you'd be interested for us to get you on the show, on that live show, and what you'd like to talk about. We're going to try and keep it to like probably like 2 to 5 minutes on those discussions to get guests coming in and out and stuff.
Yeah, definitely. It's that'll sort of firm up as we put the format of the show together, but we're keen to get your input and feedback and participation.
Yeah, definitely. Another thing that we're going to do too that week is we're going to try and do a meetup. So anybody that's listening to the show, we're going to try and find a way for CJ and I to set up a little meetup for everyone to get together and chat. So that's going to be probably sometime on Wednesday or Thursday. What we'll do is that we're going to scope out the conference on Monday and Tuesday and see what the best option would be and all that kind of stuff. But we want to see once we get on site to see what that looks like. So watch us the mailing list on Twitter and we'll set it up and let you know when that is.
Yeah.
The last thing too that CJ and I are going to do is that part of me being there to cover the conference as press, we want to make sure that we're going to put a lot of shows out that week, or we're going to put a handful of shows out. And there'll be some shows where CJ and I get together and we record stuff. There'll be some where we're going to call them like Ignite Quicks or Ignite Shorts or something, where there'll be real episodes. So they'll be showing up in our feed and everything, but they'll be very short. So they'll be probably anywhere from just a couple minutes to maybe 10 minutes long or something. Maybe like a recap from the keynote or stuff like that that we'll be pushing out. So expect a lot of stuff coming out of us from the Ignite conference. All the stuff's going to be published on our website. It's going to be published through our feed. So if you subscribe to the show, you'll get all that stuff. Same thing with the live show. The meetup is the only thing we won't be doing. But hey, I mean, I'm there for the conference. I'm there for the podcast. So I would love to also meet up with any of our listeners and sit down, maybe talk to you about things that you're doing in the cloud with AWS or with Azure or whatever. So please reach out to us prior to the show. Let us know so we can find time to link up with you and have a chat.
Excellent.
Awesome.
It's going to be exciting.
It will be exciting.
It's going to be great to have you there.
I'm very much looking forward to it. Very much looking forward to it this time.
Excellent.
So you want to do a little bit of news?
Yeah, let's do it.
Hey, man, something kind of slammed into the news last week. Of course, this is going to be about 2 or 3 weeks old once people hear this, but Microsoft, specifically the SharePoint group, published the developer preview of the SharePoint framework.
Yes.
For people to go grab up on GitHub, because it's available to you now. So they published an article up on their blog. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. From there, you can go to github.com/SharePoint, and you can now go through and create your first client-side web part using the new SharePoint developer preview that's out there. It's early, it's a preview, so don't think that this is everything. But have you had a chance to play with the dev preview yet, CJ?
I had a chance to play with it before it went into developer preview. So I went to the last, what they call developer kitchen, or this was the Dev Kitchen 3, I think it was. So this was, I think the bits have changed a little bit since then, but it was pretty close. It was a few weeks ago. So yeah, I got to go to the Dev Kitchen and play around with the bits there. And I built a new client-side web part. My web part was all about charting, using some charting controls and charting data from SharePoint lists. And so I got to play around with the framework, got to play around with the client-side stuff, only for a couple of days, though, so I haven't dug in more than that. But it's great to see it out in preview. You know, there were a lot of people having a whinge about it only being at the dev kitchens and not being available for, you know, a wider audience to play with. So I think that gives them this opportunity. And we will see what they think, I guess.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what some people's opinions are of playing with it a bit. So far, the only real opinions of the articles that I've seen that have been published about it so far have been people who this style of development seems to be a little new for them.
Yeah.
The tooling is all based on, it's all following the same kind of model of development that like a traditional Angular or client-side developer is going to do, which is, you know, using Node for a lot of your runtime, a lot of your tooling, and a lot of your packaging stuff.
Yep.
And I think that that's taken a lot of people by surprise because they are, Node.js takes a very different approach to say like .NET, where .NET you install, you know, .NET and you install Visual Studio and you have IIS and everything is kind of like a big upfront install, where Node is a tiny upfront install. And then each one of the projects you get is going to pull everything it needs to run the project. And so
yeah,
I've seen like a bunch of people talking on Facebook and on Twitter about, you know, why is this one folder a half a gig for each one of my projects? Well, I get the concern. It's a preview. I'm hoping that they're going to go through and they're going to slim it down. But what I'm really hoping to see as, and I know we heard the Office 365 developer podcast recently had Mike Ammerland, who rejoined the SharePoint team recently, to talk about the SharePoint framework. I'm most interested to hear from them specifically at Ignite about what is their target audience for this? Who do they think should be using this? What's the target scenarios for the SharePoint framework? And what is their commitment in terms of upgrading and updating and future drops of the SharePoint framework? When can we expect more and those kinds of things? I hope to see those at Ignite. I've reached out to Microsoft again to try and see if we can get somebody from the show to come and or somebody from the SharePoint team to come talk to our podcast and talk to our listeners about the SharePoint framework to also ask those questions. So we'll see if anything comes out of that as well. But until then, yeah, just it's going to be interesting to see where this stuff goes. So
yeah,
encourage you SharePoint devs to go take a look at it and, you know, let us know what you think.
Yeah, there's a good blog post that talks about kind of a little bit more than what they discussed at the Future of SharePoint event on May the 4th, kind of where they're heading. It's pretty easy to try out. There's a good getting started, like Hello World Lab. You could do it on Windows or Mac, and so you're not limited by platform there. It will be new for some people. There is going to be a bit of a learning curve, and those frustrations are real, right? There's going to be some of that. I suspect the Visual Studio team are going to come through with some tooling and baked into Visual Studio at some point, which will help for those folks who are deep in Visual Studio every day and .NET developers out in the world. But for now, what we've got is what we've got, and the node-based tooling is the first example of, or the first set of tooling. That said, it's the framework's not tied to Node per se, so I think we'll see tooling, like I said, baked into Visual Studio and other options as well for people to try out. But yeah, I think it will be a little bit different for people, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's going to freak some people out for sure, and mostly corporate developers that work in an enterprise, I think, are probably going to have the toughest time with this to get started. But that said, you know, it was the Node Foundation put out a survey recently that said that 40% of enterprises that they surveyed were using Node in some capacity in an enterprise setting. So it's certainly picking up steam, that's for sure. But it's not for everybody, right? I understand that.
Yeah, it's another way of doing stuff. I mean, there's the one thing from this that has kind of frustrated me is that the people are focusing on a lot of the wrong stuff. They're focusing on the fact, why are there so many files? Why is this one folder so big and stuff? It's like, let's talk about the framework. Let's talk about what you can build with it and what it can actually do, and that what you can, the packaging stuff, because you don't need Node to run this. Today you kind of do because that's what the tooling is based on, but all that tooling simply facilitates you testing your stuff locally and then packaging stuff up into some artifact that you go put into SharePoint. Once you go hand it over to SharePoint, once you build that artifact, that's it. It's just JavaScript, CSS, and HTML. You don't have anything else that you've got any kind of these big runtimes or anything like that. So think about it like you don't need Visual Studio to run your website. You use Visual Studio to build the website, and then you deploy some package.
Yeah, I mean, but this is the first impression people have, right? They want to try it out, so they go get the tools, and then they're like, what the hell? This is crazy. And it's different and stuff. So I think that those complaints are fair, but yeah, I wish I hope the future discussion around this stuff is more focused on what it lets you do in the product and what it lets you build and how it does it, rather than the tools that they currently have, given it's a preview and all that. But I think we should do a deep dive show on the developer framework, or on the SharePoint framework, and talk a little bit more about it. Maybe once you've had more of a chance to play with it, and we can go into some of the pros and cons and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
So, okay, so, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Have we ever done this before?
No, it doesn't sound like it.
Another big bit of news that came out today was something out of the PowerShell team. You want to share with us what that was?
Oh, yeah. So this is kind of interesting. Now, I'm not much of a PowerShell guy, but I know a lot of people are. And for me, it's just never really clicked I would rather open Visual Studio and write a piece of C# code than write PowerShell. I know that sounds really weird, but it's just the kind of the way I am for some reason. I've never really picked up on PowerShell. However, there are millions and millions of people who use it every day, right? And it's a great scripting language to use, especially on Windows. But now Microsoft have released PowerShell as open source and is available for use on Linux.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty incredible. So they've open sourced PowerShell and made it available in sort of a multi-platform, multi-OS kind of world. And so now Linux users, I guess those on Ubuntu and things like that, can use PowerShell inside that. I'm assuming this means that you could use PowerShell on the Ubuntu subsystem on Windows 10, for example.
Yep.
Also potentially in containers, Linux containers with Docker and so forth, as well as Linux on, you know, virtual machines and that sort of thing as well. Now, the beauty of this, right, is that Azure ships with a bunch of commandlets, that's the word I'm looking for. Thank you. Commandlets and things like that, so that you'd be able to use PowerShell and those commandlets on Linux to manage your Azure environments and all that sort of stuff as well, which is pretty sweet. I mean, more in the open source world, more going on, more openness, and more cross-plat stuff. Goodness.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, it wasn't just Linux too. Well, that was what they led with, is that PowerShell is open source on Linux. But when you go to the site to go download it, there's also a Mac OS distribution as well. So you can grab a DMG file, install that, and run it. good friend of mine, Ben Stenjik, has actually installed it and started playing around with it. And I know that one of the things that's not there yet, it's not completely finished, but there's some things like being able to do PowerShell remoting. Ooh. To be able to connect into another machine. I think that that's not there yet. That was one of the things that he was going for right away.
Yeah, gotcha.
But I'm with you. I mean, I played a bit with PowerShell. I've written some scripts about it. I feel I was productive enough with it. I've found that I do like the shorthand version. Since I've been living on the OS X side for so long, I do prefer to write, like, say, a Node script to go do some stuff and then run that from the command line, or doing bash scripts and stuff. And there's, because Linux and Unix have been around so long, finding help and stuff, I still fumble around with it a bit, but I really do like using it quite a bit. But I mean, it's nice to be able to see Microsoft opening this up. One thing that I did find very interesting about this, though, is that there's a PR that someone submitted to this, right? Almost immediately, within about 12 hours or 24 hours, where apparently one of the things that the PowerShell team had done is they had created two aliases, one called curl and one called wget, for two very popular Unix-based tools. And they mapped those aliases to PowerShell commandlets. But those PowerShell commandlets did not have the exact same signature, nor did they have the same return values that curl and wget had. And it was a pain point for a lot of people that were on Windows. And it wasn't until they went open source and they pushed it over to Linux as well that now they're looking at it and saying that people had a way to go through and to voice their opinion and be able to say, let me fix this for you. Hmm. It created an epic PR and comment thread that was going on. There was a lot of bashing and stuff in there, but there was a lot of constructive stuff that was going on. And Jeffrey Snover, who's one of the main guys behind PowerShell, even jumped in from Microsoft. And the disappointing thing is it looks like they just closed the PR and they didn't actually address the issue. And it was because it's a major design change that it brings up. But I'm not a big fan of what the outcome was, but I am a big fan of the fact that it started this conversation. So I thought it was it's pretty interesting to see that this came about.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I guess there'll be more like that. People will have suggestions and things they want to see in it, and they'll be able to go write them and do PRs and see what happens, see if it gets introduced. I'm kind of a copy paste script kitty when it comes to PowerShell. I don't write it from scratch. I just copy other people's stuff, and it's because there's lots of examples out there and things like that. And now it's kind of nice. I'll be able to do this on OS X or on my Ubuntu VM or what have you.
Yeah, your Ubuntu VM. All those that you have lying around.
Yeah, tons of those.
Hey,
well, there's a couple of containers. Yeah.
There you go. I had two news items here that also came out from Google. One was that Google, their cloud database services, they are now out of beta. So you may have heard of one of their products called Cloud SQL, which allows you to very easily run and manage MySQL databases in the cloud. That is now GA. And then they have another thing called, it's a big NoSQL database, which is kind of like their version of DocumentDB. It allows you to do to focus on very large analytics and operational workloads. They call that Cloud Bigtable. That's the product they have for that. That's also generally available. And I think that the other one that they had that is also part of this is the Cloud Data Store, which is their NoSQL databases for web and mobile workloads. So that was already generally available, but developers are only able to use that as part of the Google App Engine. But as part of this GA thing that they've done, they also released an API for the Cloud Data Store out of beta into GA as well. So now all of their data services that they have to offer that have had this beta tag around them and APIs have now, it's all been lifted. It's all part of GA.
Really nice.
Yeah.
On the Google thing, Google Cloud Platform Education Grants is a new program for students and faculty and education providers to go apply to get Google Cloud Platform credits to use for all sorts of different things. You can go and apply. I'm not sure exactly what the process is, and I can't really find exactly how many credits you get. I don't know how they figure that out, but you have to be currently, unfortunately, it's only in the United States, but they're hoping to expand it. You have to be at a accredited college or university, and you have to be in computer science or a related subject area. So, you can go and apply and get a bunch of those credits for things like Google App Engine, BigQuery, Vision API, and machine learning services from Google, and go try it out, which is kind of an interesting thing, right? They've got, on the Azure side, I don't know if they've got a similar thing for education. I know that they go do free credits for people through things like BizSpark and through MSDN and stuff. I'm not sure on the education side. Maybe I'll need to go find out about that. But it's a great way to get students into your platform.
Absolutely. Yeah, I thought it's a great idea. And kind of going along with the conversation we had with Alex Pierce in the previous episodes, that it's just like they do with Office 365. It's a great way to get students and to be familiar with this tool. And from a pure selfish perspective, that once they go into the workforce, that's the tool that they're familiar with. So that's the one that they want to use. And so they'll pay for it. Same thing with Azure. I mean, it's kind of like how Azure has jumped in and they've given credits to either credits or grants. Or I'm not sure how they do it, but with the Y Combinator, the startup, like the startup incubators, where they go through and give credits to that. We talked about on the show a couple months ago. But this is specific for education space. So it'll be interesting to see if Azure responds with anything on this.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So another thing we have here, switching gears from Google, is talk a little bit about Docker. So Docker had a huge milestone in the middle of August. So Docker has this thing called Docker Hub. And Docker Hub is, you can think about Docker Hub as a good analogy to it is we use GitHub or Visual Studio Team Services to store our code, store repositories. Docker Hub is a way for you to store images. So you've heard CJ and I talk about containers. When you run a container, it's an instance of a running image or a configuration of a running image. An image is just the machine or the way that the disk has been configured and the stuff that's already on it. Docker Hub is a place for you to publish your images. And so you can have public images that are posted. So you can get things like a Hello World image to make sure Docker's running. Also ones from like, say, Node or from the .NET Core guys now have official images that are out there. Or you can create private ones for just your company to use. Well, I was reading from the blog post. Then this is in the middle of August. The number of image pulls from the Docker Hub registry service reached 5 billion. That's an increase of 150% just since February of 2016. This is only a three-year-old project, so that's pretty darn amazing here. So some of the details around this that I found to be kind of fascinating here, that means that there are over 650,000 registered users are pulling images over 13,000 times a minute. That's almost twice as fast as they had just, 5 months ago when they were pulling 7,000 pulls a minute. So
yeah, that's a couple, like 240-ish a second or something.
Yeah.
That's a ton. Or maybe 220, something like that. Yeah. Excuse my poor division, but yeah, I think that's a ton per second. And I think this goes along with just the growth of Docker and how things are progressing in that ecosystem. And, you know, the popularity is really starting to take off. So it's really cool. What a milestone.
It really is. I found it really, really interesting there.
Yeah, but, very cool.
They've also had some other updates too, like Docker Cloud. They released 1.4 of that, version 1.4 of that just recently, which gives you the ability. That's their hosted service to help you manage Dockerized applications in other people's public clouds or your own private cloud. So it can like spin up containers on different hosts where you have Docker installed, either physical or virtual machines, and say AWS or DigitalOcean or Google or Azure or your own server in your office. And you can provide it like an application definition file. They call it a stack. And it will go pull the images it needs to pull and create those images, make them run and monitor and all that stuff. So pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. We use it a lot at Hyperfish to run our dev stage integration and prod environments.
Yeah. It's one of the key things I'm using right now as well with the application I'm working on. So
nice.
So, hey, we've talked a bit here about a bunch of news here, but we did have a couple listener questions that have come in recently, and one of them was in response to episode 141. So I was, a couple weeks ago, I had to drive up and go pick up my son at camp up in North Carolina, so I had a nice two full days of 9 hours in the car, 8 hours in the car or something. And at one point on the way up, Paul Schaeflein and I, who's been on the show a couple times, we jumped on the phone and started talking about all sorts of things, from the SharePoint framework to Docker to all this stuff. And it triggered him to submit a question in about the topic that we were talking about. So he actually had two questions here. He was nice enough to record these and send us a file. So let's go ahead and let's play his questions on the air. And then I got to ask you a question about what one of the things he had.
Hey, this is Paul Schaeflein, and you mentioned you wanted listener questions. So I have two of them. The first, in the context of Office 365 bookings, how does CJ know so much about a hair salon works? The second question You heard you talk quite a bit about containers, and I understand that containers are kind of a middle ground between platform as a service and infrastructure as a service. But if I'm moving my on-prem stuff to a platform as a service, it seems that containers are a step backwards because now I need to have VMs that manage the containers. Am I missing something? I'd love to hear your thoughts on how containers can be best used for developers and their teams. Thanks. Keep up the great work.
All right. So Paul's question, he had two questions here. So CJ, first question was in response to episode 141, when we talked a little bit here about a hair salon and people looking what things are going to install in there. How do you know so much about a hair salon?
Oh, it's kind of a long story, but I have a friend who has a friend who owns a hair salon. And many years ago, him and I were talking about building software to go replace this crappy software that the guy was using in his hair salon. And it never went anywhere, but we went and looked at it, at some of the systems they use and things like that, and we're just kind of blown away at how backwards it was back then. So I suspect it's exactly the same now.
Probably.
So, you know, I don't spend a lot of time hanging out in hair salons, obviously, or maybe not obviously, but... if anybody's seen my haircut, you'll realize I don't. But yeah, no, that's how I know a little bit about hair salon software.
Interesting. I learned a little bit about you there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I guess the meat of his question, though, the thing we really wanted to talk about was that, you know, Paul was saying, you know, if you already built an application, and let's say you've built it based on PaaS, using a PaaS style architecture. So you're using like hosted services like Azure App Service and maybe using things like Azure SQL Database and stuff like that. We've talked a little bit about containers and we've talked about, you know, what you need to run them and the fact how, like Paul mentions, that you need a host to be able to run your containers. Mm. And that's going to be a virtual machine or it's going to be hardware, which goes to IaaS. And so he's asking, you know, hey, with, you know, people talking about building applications with PaaS, if you move over to containers, isn't that kind of a quote step? As Paul put it, is that a step backwards, moving more towards IaaS? Do you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'd kind of tackle it from the other direction and say that the majority of apps right now in enterprises are built not with PaaS in mind. You know, they're built sort of in traditional ways. And for moving stuff like that to the cloud, it is a ton easier to do things like Dockerizing them or running them in a slightly less PaaS way and a little bit more abstracted from IaaS like that Docker provides than it is to rewrite them to pure PaaS. Sure, if you're writing an application with PaaS in mind right from the beginning, then Docker's probably not for you. But that's not the majority of applications that enterprises are trying to move today. Mm. Most of them have been written, you know, that either run on VMs or run, you know, an IIS or what have you on boxes in their organization. And those types of apps are much, much easier to, you know, Dockerize, for want of a better word, and take advantage of some of the benefits of containerization than the opposite. So I'd actually sort of tackle it from that direction more than why would I rewrite a PaaS app to be Docker compatible or take advantage of Docker, and rather say that my approach on that would be the other way around and say that most traditional based apps are probably better suited to being moved to something like that and take advantage of some of the things in Docker.
Yeah, so I agree with everything you just said. I'm going to throw one or two other, like, thoughts out there. First, I mean, I think that, you know, if you've built something that works with PaaS, that built something for PaaS and everything works just fine, it's kind of hard to make a case to say why you would kind of go in a direction towards IaaS, which is going to be more containers. If things are working, I don't really see a reason why you'd fix it. There's not much, too much you're going to gain there.
Yeah.
But I think that when you, like you said, when you're going to build an application, you're really going to choose, do I want to go more with this closer to IaaS approach, which is what containers are really going to give you more control over your environment, or do you want to go with much more of a PaaS approach, which is saying, I really just want to use a service and I don't want to worry about how the underpinnings work or control that stuff. And, you know, to each their own, there's advantages and disadvantages of each thing. I think that one thing I do see from some people, and I know that you and I talked back at the Build conference, not this past year, but the year before, we talked to the guys, Rob Walling and Derek Weimer from GitTrip, where when they built their application from the scratch about 3 years ago, they decided to go with IaaS and not go with PaaS because they didn't want to bank on specific vendors on the different PaaS services that they offered.
Yeah.
So one of the choices that really at the time, they had the option there, but it really wasn't like the big thing that we were hearing about at the time. It was really kind of a brand new thing, was containers to a lot of people at that time. now if they were going to go through and build that today, then they would have that option to say, I do have the option to maybe go with something like a container service or going with containers instead of working with IaaS and having to babysit the servers and feed and water them. But I don't want to have that kind of buy into a specific cloud and work just with that, you know, with what PaaS services the Azure offers or what AWS offers. I mean, you see, Microsoft is really is giving us the best of both worlds with this today, too, with Azure, where we're overdue on getting somebody on the show to talk to us about Service Fabric. But I think that, you know, what Service Fabric is really Microsoft's PaaS container offering, where you're really building containerized-like things, but you're doing it in a PaaS way, meaning that you have to conform to what two different development models that Microsoft offers, either like this Actor model, I forget what the other one is, but you build for it, but you get a lot of the benefits of containers, but not all of them and also not all the baggage because you're letting Microsoft go through and manage this for you. So it's a good question, Paul. Definitely a very good question, but I think that there's no, I guess, one answer to it. I think it like CJ was saying, it's you got to how are you kind of coming at this? It's just another, to me, it's another tool in the toolbox.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I chose containers and Docker for building what we're building at Hyperfish was a couple of reasons. One, platform independence. So we do run on Azure a lot and we take advantage of some Azure services, but the core of our application is not PaaS based on Azure. It's Docker and container based. So it does run on virtual machines in Azure ultimately, but you know, to be honest, we've very abstracted away from the virtual machines and it really is extremely similar to writing a PaaS type application. But the reason we did that is we're quite independent. We could run part of our application on AWS, part of it on Azure if we wanted, part of it on our own hardware. We wouldn't have to rewrite stuff. And then we're very conscious about when we take a dependency on a specific platform, specific API, at least we're doing that in a very conscious way. We know we're taking a hard dependency on Azure for something. We could just be very deliberate about that. And then the second thing is developer productivity. So if you're building on a PaaS platform, you've got to have really kick-ass local developer support for those PaaS APIs and things like that. So, for example, like DocumentDB, you can't do local development with DocumentDB unless you do something like the Mongo adapter and run a local Mongo database, for example. So you're going to have these dependencies that you need to replicate in your developer environment. Some of them are easier than others to replicate. Docker, bunch easier. You can run it all locally for the most part, unless you of course, have those dependencies on specific platform provider APIs. But for us, it's incredibly productive for a developer to be able to spin up our whole system on their own dev box and things. So that's really the two reasons why we do it. But it's different strokes for different folks, and it's what suits you best. Some will be PaaS and some won't be.
Yeah, I just one more thing I did want to throw onto that is to your second point there. That's one of the appeals that I have with it is that, you know, I've got stuff that I've built for Azure PaaS, for Azure App Service and deploy them. But the challenge that I've always had with it, the part that's always frustrating to me is that, you know, when I do this stuff, my testing locally is never exactly, it's never going to run exactly like it runs up in Azure. It may be very, very close, but my runtime is never the same. I mean, trying to, like, for example, I use Orchard to host this podcast, my website, some other stuff as well. And running it locally, it's never the exact same as running it up in Azure.
Yeah.
It's pretty darn close, but I've almost stopped doing the development local and tried to run stuff up in Azure just to be able to do all my testing. I have a specific tenant that I've created app service I've created just for that website. And one of the things I like about, you know, this container style or this Dockerized style development is that, like what you said, what's running on my machine is exactly the same thing that's going to be running on wherever I deploy it. And even if it's not, like, for example, I'm using a message queue service, and I know you guys do the same thing, but I'm using a message queue service. I like the fact that I'm not paying for a queuing service in a hosted solution right now. I'm using a local Rabbit image, but I'm not worrying about the load balancing and all that kind of stuff right now. But then when I want to go push this up into staging or into production, then I know that I'm not going to be using my own thing. I'm going to go purchase a service that does hosted queue. Messaging and has queuing for me, and I just change a connection string, and my app is no longer using a local container. I'm actually using a hosted container, but they're the same version, so I'm in good shape.
Yeah.
It just simplifies the development. To me, it simplifies the development story a lot.
Yeah, I agree.
So, okay, we have another question that I wanted to ask you about and get your thoughts on. So this question is from, and excuse me if I mess up the name here, I think it's Akiva Marks. This question, it says a question about LAMP. So it says, our corporate parent is pushing an Azure corporate strategy. Apparently, Microsoft did a great sales job and included Azure in their enterprise licensing. Well, they're very good at that. But our subsidy is a LAMP stack and or LAMP shop, and it includes some products which only support MySQL. While Microsoft has said that they're putting up a competitive non-Microsoft services set, I'm not seeing it. Their MySQL third-party provider is rated poor and certainly can't compete with Amazon's RDS in performance and reliability. So his question, he says, my question is simple. When's Microsoft going to get serious about non-Microsoft cloud services instead of blowing smoke? I love the direct question there. So Let's
not mince words or anything.
No. And his point about MySQL, I've heard people say that as well with who are using like WordPress, trying to host WordPress on Azure, and they're using the MySQL option from Azure, and the performance is not what they've all been looking for.
Well, it's not really Azure, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
It's run by a third-party service, and it's to get around things like WordPress hosting, give them an easy way to get a MySQL database. But it's not exactly what I would call a first-party, configurable, high-performance, flexible MySQL offering, for example. So, there's a lot to be desired there.
Yeah, it is. Now, but with that being said, some stuff has changed recently, right?
That's true. That is true. But before we get to that...
Oh, sorry.
One thing before we get to that is... So put aside their third-party offering for a second because it's kind of crappy, right? And I think everybody's aware of that. So you don't really want to use that. So what that leaves you with is running it yourself. So in Azure today, you can go provision up, you know, a cluster of VMs or what have you and go run MySQL yourself if you want. But they don't have like a PaaS-type offering of MySQL, which is really the crux of what this guy's question is. Amazon RDS is obviously can be very performant and is very flexible on, you know, what options you get and all that sort of stuff. And really what he's looking for is a similar offering to that, but from Azure. And I think the Azure team are acutely aware of this being a sore spot in their offering for the open source world or non-Microsoft stack world, I guess. And so there has been some news recently in this regard, specifically around MySQL and what they're starting to offer.
Yeah, and this, just to be clear, for listeners that aren't sure what he's talking about, when he says, you know, what Amazon RDS, so MySQL is a relational database. Amazon RDS is Amazon Relational Database Service, which it supports. There's a bunch of different options that are available to you. There's Aurora, which is an Amazon database. There's PostgreSQL, MySQL, MariaDB, Oracle, and SQL Server, the ones that Amazon supports. Today, Microsoft, their support for that has always been, in production, has been SQL Server, and there are some Oracle options, but it's really been SQL Server. And so the news that came out this week, or around in the middle of August, was that they announced a MySQL app preview for web apps. So this is not intended today for production style things, but some of the key highlights from this is that it supports PHP and MySQL applications like WordPress, Joomla, and Drupal. It's a MySQL server running on the same instance side by side with your web server hosting the site, which will boost performance of your web app. The storage is shared between both MySQL and your web app. There are free and shared plans that may hit quota limits when you're using the site-based or actions to perform. So make sure you check into those quota limitations for free and shared plans. And you can also turn on slow query logging and general logging for MySQL. This obviously can affect performance as well. But I do this for for my SQL Server instance that I use for the Orchard deployment that I use to host the podcast website and my blog, to where it watches for slow queries and even does some suggested optimizations that can be done.
Yeah. The issue with this, right, is it's really a dev-only thing, and it's meant for kind of lightweight workloads like WordPress and stuff like that. It's not meant to be like a highly scalable, redundant, performant database system that you can go build your app and slam with data and use all that sort of stuff. For that, you're still going to need something else. You're either going to need to host your MySQL server yourself or use a third-party offering to do it. Now, the next step, right, this is a developer-only thing. I don't think it's much of a stretch to say that Azure may go further with this in the future and do something in this space. So I guess we'll have to just wait and see on that. But I think they get that this is a sore spot. This seems to be a step in the right direction, but I doubt it's the last we'll see from them.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully we'll see something at Ignite, but I mean, we don't know anything about that, but we'll be covering it if it is.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I totally get this, especially with things like Postgres as well. Like, it would be in Azure's best interests, I would say, to offer a similar thing to RDS with Postgres and MySQL to let people at least run workloads that they've already built, apps they've already built, move them to Azure more seamless and easily. Because if they're trying to win share off Amazon, then they're going to need something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you think we don't have an Azure. If you think Azure has an RDS offering, they do, but it's just one. It's SQL Server.
Yeah.
So,
and honestly, like, we at Hyperfish, we use Postgres, and we're on Azure, and we outsource running our Postgres cluster to a third party because they can do it better than we can. They run it in Azure, but it's a couple of VMs or two or three VMs or something in a Postgres cluster. So it runs in VMs in Azure, and that's the way we do it. But like I said, we outsource it because we don't know how to run a Postgres cluster as well as they do.
Yes.
But if they had a database service in Azure that would provide us highly available, flexible, and redundant and performant Postgres database service, we would absolutely use it.
Yeah. So cool options there.
Versus hosting it ourselves. Mm.
Cool. Well, hey, I'd say we got some news. We've done a couple listener questions here. We got about going a little long on this one. You want to throw a couple picks in just for fun?
Yeah, sure. I've got one, you've got three, so I'll go first just to get them out of the way, huh?
That sounds good. Go ahead.
Hey, so our friends at Gsoft, who also have ShareGate, have recently launched a new product that they sort of did in kind of hackathon-style fashion internally at Gsoft. It's called Lighthouse. It's real-time monitoring and alerts for Slack administrators. So this is kind of a cool product. It's up on Product Hunt, and we'll list off, fire a link off to that. But this is a way, if you're a Slack customer, to get notified of interesting things going on in your Slack environment. So things like particular keywords, like passwords or social security numbers being shared. You can go see activity logs about what's happening with various channels when they get deleted or archived or closed or created or what have you. It'll go and sit there and do sort of real-time monitoring and analysis on your Slack environment and help you sort of stay sane and clean and all that sort of stuff. And it's all sort of baked into Slack. It's quite nice.
That's cool.
They actually ran this in a really interesting way. They set up a sort of a temporary office in Prague, and they send people on rotations into their Prague house, so to speak, or Gsoft house, I think they call it. And they went and built this in a couple of weeks and have now launched it. So it's up on Product Hunt, and definitely go check it out if you're a Slack customer.
Very
it's free
cool.
for now as well.
Very cool. Very cool. Okay, so I've got three picks. First one's really short, but I find this to be a huge resource, and I just haven't shared it in the past. It's Design Patterns in TypeScript. So if you are familiar at all with like the Gang of Four or certain programming patterns that we have in different languages, sometimes it can be kind of hard to figure out, how do I implement this same thing inside of this other language that I'm working with? And I know TypeScript helps those people who are moving over to the JavaScript side. A lot of JavaScript developers have adopted TypeScript. I know TypeScript is going to be a big piece of the whole SharePoint framework where they've done it in TypeScript and they're definitely recommending you do it, as is like Angular 2. And so this guy's got a really good little repo. It's fairly old, but it doesn't need to keep being updated. It's really good though. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but you want to find things like an implementation of like the adapter pattern or the chain of responsibility or compositor decorator or factory pattern. This is a little spot that I've cloned it, but I also keep it bookmarked and go check into this every once in a while to have a really good example of just, how would you go through and implement this pattern? So not only does he have an example of each one, some of them have a little readme as well to go with it to explain what's going on, but you can look at the code and figure it out.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a really good little resource. Another one here. Both of these things are going to be a little containerish or very containerish. So one of them is a company called Rancher, and Rancher has created this thing called Rancher OS. It's a tiny Linux distribution that runs an entire operating system as Docker containers. Now, think about this. This is a really cool little concept. So what they've done is you have a tiny little operating system, tiny Linux operating system, about 19 megs. And what it has is effectively two different Docker runtimes running on it. One of them is for system and one of them is for user. So the system one, you have things like a console or things like a syslog or things like an event viewer or something like that. Maybe even a UX, like a Windows-based experience there. Each one of these different things is set up as a container. So you can mix and match the different things that you're going to use and how they talk to each other and stuff. But it's running completely separate from all of your user stuff. And so what you can do is have you have your user-based Docker containers where if you build things like an application, like a calculator or Microsoft Word or, you know, whatever, you can have two different spaces that are running to where your stuff is totally separate from the system. You can upgrade parts of the application or upgrade parts of the system very easily. It's a really cool little concept. I mean, it's nothing like full blown here, but the thing is that it's, think about it as an operating system that everything is a container. So one runs the kernel and one, which is replacing things like traditional initialization system and system services. And the other one is a user level thing to keep all your stuff separate. So
yeah, that's pretty clever.
Yeah, it's neat. You can go grab it today and even request a little demo from them to show it off and stuff. It's pretty cool. They call it the minimum viable operating system.
I thought that was Vista. Oh man. Sorry, inside words.
All right. So the next thing, the last one that I have here is someone has built their own open source PaaS on Docker. So this project's called Atlantis, and there's a bunch of different components to it. But essentially what they've done is they've created their own PaaS offering where each one of the different PaaS services runs in its own container. So say, for example, let's take Azure as an example. If you were going to do, like, say, Azure App Service, someone has built, or these guys have built, a Atlantis container called, say, App Service, and you can go through and spin up multiple instances of this app service and then build your container that's based off of this guy to be able to run your application. You can do that for a lot of different things. They've got a bunch of different options here. They have a bunch of different components that they've built up as well. They've got a supervisor that is the thing that manages all the different containers and handles network security. They have routers that are all based off of this one thing called ZooKeeper, which is a pretty popular solution. Stores configuration data and propagates updates out immediately. It's got a Jenkins implementation as well, to where you can handle all your build pipeline. It's got an LDAP piece as well. It's got a builder. It's got, I think I said routers. It's got a registry, which is like an implementation of the Docker registry to be able to pull in applications. Think about that almost like an Azure store. And you got a manager as well that does everything. So it's pretty early on, but it's stumbled across Hacker News on this a couple of days ago, and kind of poked around and found that it was a complete time suck for me and had to move on. But it's pretty interesting, though. You can go take a look at it. They show different ways of how you can actually get it set up on EC2, or even you could easily port that over to Azure as well. But it's pretty interesting.
That's clever. Yeah, I'd like to take a look at that.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, think about it like this. Their PaaS that they've offered here, building on containers, this is a lot like Azure's Service Fabric.
Gotcha.
Right? So think of Azure Service Fabric as what runs all of the Microsoft Azure services like App Service and Logic Apps and SQL Azure and stuff like, or Azure SQL Server and stuff like that. Think of this as Atlantis as kind of like an open source version of Service Fabric.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. So it's interesting stuff here. I didn't say go use it right away, but interesting to see how people are doing it.
Nice.
Yeah, man. So we covered some news, covered a little bit of what our plans are at Ignite, covered some listener questions, a couple picks. Yeah, so I mean, anything else you want to share with our listeners before we wrap this one up?
No, I'm getting more and more excited about Ignite with every day, not just on the Hyperfish side, but on the Microsoft Cloud Show side. I'm glad we've got all the stuff lined up. We'll keep people posted, but we really want to make it rock. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be a lot of fun to cover the show as a part of the media, the press. So I'll be blogging a little bit about that too, about what that experience is like. I've already seen some cool little things that you get to do ahead of the show and stuff that
yeah, you get the behind the scenes.
Yeah, I have to sequester myself for about 24 hours apparently, which is going to be kind of interesting, but I get to write, just make sure to turn off my internet connection for some stuff.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, embargoed content and all that.
Oh yeah, yeah, it'll be interesting. So well,
very cool,
man. We will talk to you again next week, and definitely, everybody, pay attention to the Twitter handle and sign up for the mailing list if you want to find out what's going on with Ignite. We will definitely let you know, and on future episodes.
Rock on.
Cool. Take it easy, CJ.
Did you like this episode? Send us a tweet about it and drop us a 5-star review in iTunes. Word of mouth recommendations are the most effective ways for us to grow the show. We'd really appreciate it. If you have a question for us, go to microsoftcloudshow.com/questions, where you can submit it as text. We'll record it as a WAV or an MP3 and provide a link so that we can play your question on the show. Our theme music is an excerpt from Evaporated Air by Monk Turner, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes and the Google Play Store by searching for Microsoft Cloud Show or via RSS at microsoftcloudshow.com, where you'll also find show notes of each episode. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for Microsoft Cloud Show, or on Twitter at MS Cloud Show. And finally, sign up to our mailing list by heading to our website and entering your email to interact with us, participate in upcoming interviews, and other cool stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.